just hopping online, seeing what kind of work has been done. But I would urge folks to check all the local nonprofits and find something that focuses on something you're passionate about and work with them and find out, because volunteer opportunities are going to come back for all of these organizations eventually, including us. And a lot has changed over the last year. So I suspect the needs of organizations are going to change. And when the local folks start working, the urge for the money to stay locally becomes clear. That means we're not asking for federal funds to fund these organizations. We're taking care of our own. So it's checking in, seeing who needs what, checking in with the other organizations. As far as Call to Safety, our website is still calltosafety.org, all one word. And once again, our crisis line is 503-235-5333 or 1-888-235-5333.
Amy Davidson with Partnership for Safety and Justice and Alexis Robinson Woods with Call to Safety. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/Prison Pipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers and thank you for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, bringing you special programming all day for International Women's Day. KBOO is only possible because of our members, so show your support for volunteer-powered radio today by making a one-time or monthly donation at kboo.fm/give, or pick up your smartphone and text IWD to phone number 44321. Stay tuned, because coming up next is more International Women's Day programming.
Hello, my friends. This is Life During Wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands, and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air. So we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
Good evening. You are listening to Trans Positive here on KBOO Community Radio. Today is International Women's Day, and we are very honored to have a great collection of transgender women with us tonight to talk about International Women's Day, talk about our experiences as trans women, and issues that, you know, we would like to share with you, our KBOO audience. So I would just like to go around the room first and have everyone introduce themselves, and please share as much as you'd like with us. I'm going to start with Claire to my left. So Claire, if you would like to introduce yourself and your pronouns and tell us all about yourself, who are you?
Well, thanks, Emma. Yeah, my name is Claire Hall. I am a 61-year-old transgender woman. I came out 3 years ago. I was born, grew up in Portland, but I've been in Newport since 1987. Worked in local newspapers and radio for about 18 years before I was elected a county commissioner. Mm-hmm. And I am now in my 17th year in that job. And finally, I reached the point in my life after a lifetime of finding excuses not to transition. I just one day realized I was out of excuses, and I thought it might be a bit risky in, you know, transitioning in public office. You know, we don't have many transgender elected officials, and as far as I'm been able to determine, I'm the first and only to have actually transitioned on the job. And even though I have faced a small degree of transphobia, I mean, just the embrace of the community has been very wonderful, very affirming, and I'm very grateful for that.
Thank you. Our next guest is a regular host here on Transpositive, and that's Jean, who's to my bottom left here on my Zoom screen. Jean, would you like to introduce yourself and give us your pronouns and tell us all about yourself?
I'm Jean Bryant, and as Emma, you know, says, I'm a regular co-host here on Transpositive. I want to model an interesting behavior that it comes from a show we did just recently with Lucy Fielding. So I'm Jean Bryant. My pronouns are she, her, they, them. I am a white, binary, low femme.
Ooh.
Okay, low femme woman of trans experience. I came of age. Well, I'm not going to tell you exactly like Claire did, but I came of age in the very early 1970s. That gives you some idea. You know, a lot of my transition experience happened under SOC, you know, 5 and 6 and 7. I am also privileged to be, you know, retired. I'm not currently working, so I'm not in the workforce. And I'm privileged to actually have housing and in healthcare and stuff like that. So I'm coming from a place of privilege, and I recognize that. My history, a lot of my history is in organized labor. So I have been a national level union official. I've been raging against the system for decades.
Great, thank you. And we also have Sheila with us. Sheila, I noticed that you're on mute. I think that may have happened by accident. If you could just press unmute on your phone. And please introduce yourself.
Well, first, can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, because I hadn't muted it. That's all right. Okay, well, my name is Sheila. I tend to go by first names just for somewhat my own safety. I've lived kind of a private existence in recent years, but I did my transition at age of 34. But it was kind of an in and out transition in some ways, because these were the days, especially when the Oregon Citizens Alliance and other groups were coming up to Washington, and there was a lot of battle around the issues of LGBT rights. And I was part of that. And I think that some of the trauma from those years still remains with me. But the way that I was able to reach out to the community was that the Janus Information Facility out of San Francisco was one of the first trans information publications. It was done by an Anglican nun, Sister Elizabeth, and she basically published anything that I sent her and was wonderful about that. And I was surprised later on when the internet started to find out that some of those articles were floating in even foreign countries. And so that inspired me to write a book called Transsexualism and Its Discontents, A Political Profile. So the avenue that I kind of am approaching the whole transgender experience is based on how do we create space for our own individual existence, and how do we create space for ourselves as a community. And it's, in some respects, it's never been more challenging. And what I hope I can talk about tonight is how do we survive in a meme culture? How do we survive in a situation where so much of the narrative has escaped us? We used to have kind of more control over it. Now our friends are advancing our cause much more beyond our own political ability to make things happen. And in some ways that benefits us, and in some ways it doesn't. And I listened to the CPAC conference, and President Trump today, I was wondering if he would bring up the transgender issue. And he brought up the idea that women's sports are now at risk because of all the transgender people. And to add insult to injury, he mentioned specifically weightlifting. And of course, always referred to transgender people as biological males. Very painful rhetoric. And interesting that we have become now such a center point. So I wanted to touch on that tonight. Pronouns, I kind of let my appearance decide. So certainly she and he. Most of the time I'm a girl, I would say. Sometimes during this lockdown, if it's a matter of going out, if it's a windy day on the beach, I just plop something on my head to keep my head warm, and I just walk out the door. But usually I grew up in kind of the glam culture of the drag queens in Washington State. They were kind of my role models. So Christina will tell you that I kind of went that way. Drag culture influenced me tremendously. And so some of my experience comes out of that, which makes me kind of interstitial in that I kind of felt like I was able to visit the LGBT, each of those letters in turn, in a way. And so that's where my experience comes from. And it's good to be here.
Thank you so much. And my name is Emma Lugo. I use she and her pronouns. I transitioned about 10 years ago. I've known that I was transgender since I was about 5 years old. And I consider myself a feminist. Almost all of my role models in life have been women, and they've mostly been feminists. They've mostly been like strong women who I really just admired and looked to for peer support. And, you know, I see myself as a feminist. And I don't know if I'm the best feminist in the world. I mean, I'm actually a really bad feminist. But I mean, I do try to be a good feminist, as good as I can be. And I'm trying to be better. But the point is that I think that sisterhood is universal. I see myself as a part of the community of women. And I think that International Women's Day is a great day to celebrate women and women's achievement and women's identity. And I understand that transgender women have a different experience of womanhood from other kinds of women. And there's lots of different kinds of women, and they all have different experiences of womanhood. But I understand that our experience is really unique. And I think that part of why it's so valuable, and I'm really grateful to KBOO for including Trans Positive on International Women's Day. I think the part of what's really valuable about including trans women on International Women's Day is that we have a really unique perspective on womanhood, because we've had to fight and we've had to work so hard in order to get our rights and in order to like achieve any kind of recognition and have any kind of identity. And we've had to do this in the face of patriarchy. All of us are very well versed in how incredibly damaging patriarchy is, because a lot of trans women were raised in very patriarchal cultures. And we had to work through all of that in order to, become the selves that we are. So Anyways, thank you so much, KBOO, for including us today on International Women's Day. And we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of topics. We're going to be getting into a lot of stuff that Sheila's been doing some research on, and we're going to touch on some stuff that Jean's been talking about. And we're also going to talk to Claire, and you know, really look to Claire for leadership, because Claire is an elected leader here in Oregon, and so has some sense of what's happening, you know, and the on that level of legislation, and can give us some insight. So why don't we start, Sheila, with your topic, that very first thing that you were mentioning.
Okay. Well, this is going to sound somewhat academic, but I think the tools of academia can actually help us to understand our experience. And one of the memes that's coming up right now is this idea of making people disappear. This whole idea that by limiting hate speech, which is primarily how Facebook and other places have used it so far, in Twitter, and suspending, for instance, President Trump's account off of Twitter, was somehow an effort to make other people disappear and interfere with free speech. Well, this is an example of how tools can be used against us that have nothing to do with free speech. Free speech has never been a completely open board anyway. It is never a license to abuse other people. But by treating it that way, somehow or other, we are put in the position of being the victimizer. We are the people that are trying to shut down debate, stifle knowledge, and somehow co-opt the conversation. In point of fact, that is not what we're doing, but that is what has been done to us. In the very early days of transgender science, one of the things that struck me most evidently was there would have a talk show, and that at that time, that was the only forum that you ever got to actually see transgender people appear. And what I always noticed was that they would have several transgender people on the stage and maybe one psychologist. And the talk show host would wait till the transgender people had spoken and then turn to the psychologist and say, "Well, now, can you tell us about what the transgender experience is really all about?" In other words, interpret it in such a way that our witness of our own lives was simultaneously invalidated, because it should have been the other way around. There might have been the presentation of a theory from the psychologist, and then it would be tested against our actual experience. But it was always as though we were like waterfowl in some ecology study being studied by somebody hiding in the bushes that was observing us, rather than to come to us and ask for our experience. So that raises the very first question, and it was a feminine shibboleth to say that the personal is political. And I've always thought that was remarkably insightful, because simply to exist as a transgender person is already a political statement. Because the minute that we walk out on the street, our existence can be negated by violence, it can be negated by cruel comments, by misgendering, or simply by laughing at us after we've passed. And so the big problem of transgender existence becomes to how visible do we want to be? If we become completely visible, but invisible in the sense that we are not challenging gender norms, our lives become easier. We get a lot of the benefits of that are accorded to pretty people and young people in society, but simultaneously we lose our value as immediate witness to the members of our community that either are older, not as pretty, or don't pass. And so there's a real tension built there, in that the success of some breeds the more need to make others invisible. And so the technology of being transgender has gotten to the point now where we have facial feminization surgery, but not everyone can afford it. It has good results, but again, it makes you invisible to that degree. And in that sense, the politics of transgender never gets dealt with, because nobody notices that you're there. So it's a real paradox. In order to be politically visible, we have to come out of hiding. And some of our very pretty people, like Janet Mock and other people, have made a point of saying, "I'm out of the closet. I could disappear, but I choose not to. I choose to be there with everybody else. And that's what kind of where we're at. The thing that frightens me right now, and this is the other side of politics, is that the political power is being removed from us to be self-defining, and it's being defined by narratives that have very little to do with us. For instance, the school sports issue has no bearing on elder transgender people that are long out of school and are never going to play intramural sports. So it doesn't even touch us. And yet, this is one of the primary modalities where conservative talk shows that I've listened to lately go into this whole thing. Well, they're trying to get into our locker rooms. They're trying to set new records in various sports, and completely negating the fact that, one, there are that implies, number one, that everyone's trying to do it. Number two, that every sport is equally advantageous if you are transgender, and it's presuming that all transgender people are very, very powerful people. For instance, President Trump today raised weightlifting. He did not raise tennis. He didn't talk about the uneven parallel bars, in which case it was actually beneficial to be a smaller stature and not as large as many transgender folk are, just on the basis of our early hormone exposure. So what I'm seeing all around me is I'm seeing a battle for how do we announce ourselves. And so if we even have a phrase and we're looking for terms and we say, I'm a trans woman, and then we say trans women are women. And this phrase in some ways is very valuable because it says we desire inclusion. We don't desire to be a parallel sex. But on the other hand, that implies and that leads into a narrative where they say, well, see, transgender people are trying to make genetic females or XX females disappear by somehow moving in and co-opting space that was formerly owned by someone else. So we get an imperialist narrative going on where it's almost like someone saying, you've moved tanks across the border and are now occupying part of Poland. And so automatically we're defending something that's a geographical metaphor that's applied to a personal experience of inclusion that doesn't diminish anybody else's right to be included at the same time. But by phrasing it and making phrases and words have magic power, suddenly what happens is we're fighting battles that's so divorced from our actual experience was to simply say, don't fire us, don't throw us out of our jobs, don't yell epithets at us, and above all, don't beat us up and kill us, which is a pretty small desire for live space. And it certainly doesn't impinge on anybody else. It's simply to survive. And for most of transgender existence, that's where our battles were. We're simply on survival issues.
Sheila? Great. Yeah. So I'm gonna cut you off here for just a minute, Sheila, because that was like the best like intro I've ever heard for a great conversation.
Thank you.
So much there. We have like two other guests here who are just as equally super intelligent as you, which is great. I love that. Trans women are very smart. So Jean is going to go first. Jean has a lot to say in response to what you've said. And then we're going to let Claire speak after that. Go ahead, Jean.
Okay. First of all, you know, there's nothing in what you laid out that, you know, I would argue with. That's not my point here. But I do want to, I think, frame our conversation in the context of International Women's Day. And so while I would say arguably what I just heard, you know, did establish a connection, you know, what do we have to offer in the context of International Women's Day that doesn't, you know, arguably do respect, kind of maybe belong on Transgender Day of Visibility or or one of, one of the days that we claim for ourselves exclusively as a subset. As trans women, I think really this conversation needs to focus on, how do we align ourselves? How do we participate in the broader spectrum of women's issues, not just in the United States, but in Ghana and Latin America and Indonesia and across the world, because that is the context of the airtime that we've been offered. So I do challenge us to at least bring our comments into focus of that context. And again, due respect, clearly everything that I heard, just a moment ago, bespeaks our experience in a dominant, misogynistic, male-dominated paradigm, okay? That's the one thing I will point to. I mean, we absolutely, regardless of whether we engage in a debate as to whether we, can claim full identity with, every other woman in the world, I don't think that's even the point. I think the point has to do with, and I'm bringing this back around to our own position as trans folks and as trans women, what we hope for, what we struggle for as much as anything is allyship. And if we want to have allies, especially within the broader community of women, we have to be allies. It's not a unilateral thing. It's a joining together. It's an intersectionality. And so I would hope that we can focus our conversation this evening on those elements of our lived experience. I, for one, at the risk of making light, I kind of call myself, Joanne Suburbia. I have a certain amount of passing privilege. So I function in the world and have for years and years. I mean, I honestly have to struggle to remember times when I was misgendered, okay? Just, going to the grocery store, going to the gas station, almost doing anything. So if there's a foundation for me to claim a participation, and that participation could arguably be limited to an allyship with other women of the world, in terms of their lived experience, it's like I live it every day now. I didn't live it every day of my life, unfortunately, but I live it every day of my life now. And I do claim the mantle of woman, though it does have the little postscript of trans experience. I have to own that.
Thank you, Jean.
That's probably enough for now, and we'll give Claire space here.
Thank you, and I just want to acknowledge that everyone's perspective here is valid, and so whatever people want to say that's part of the show topic is completely, completely welcome, and we're really interested in hearing whatever you have to say. You've been invited onto this program because your opinions and your views as a transgender woman are really important. So I just want to say that for everyone. Claire, thank you so much for joining us. It's just such a pleasure having you here. What are some of your thoughts about the topics that we've been covering so far between Jean and Sheila?
Absolutely a fascinating discussion, and it's got my brain cells firing in a million different directions at once, but I really like the idea of allyship. Certainly women's issues, whether cis or trans, are healthcare, housing, equal pay, battling misogyny, battling racism. You know, I remember when I was coming out to acquaintances and I had one woman tell me that be prepared for men to think your IQ suddenly dropped 20 points overnight. And I've experienced some of that. And certainly allyship with the larger LGBTQ community, which, you know, I think is so essential. I mean, like, you know, at the national level, the Equality Act has finally passed the House of Representatives, and I know it faces a harder, much harder battle in the Senate. I wouldn't be surprised if the Senate Republicans try to filibuster it, but yeah, if we can get that codified into law, we don't have to rely on executive orders anymore that can be reversed by a future administration. So yeah, I think building as big a tent, reaching out to as many allies as possible is absolutely essential.
Thank you. I want to come back to you for just a minute, Claire, because you have a unique perspective of being an elected official. And so as a trans woman, you're in a really unique perspective. Where do you see trans rights going in terms of our legal, you just mentioned the Equality Act, so that was a big plus. What do you think is going on legislatively here in Oregon and nationally that we really need to pay attention to? You know, where are things moving forward and where are they moving backwards? Do you have any take on that?
You know, a huge victory a couple of years ago was when the Oregon legislature updated the hate crime law from the mid-1980s to include gender identity. And sadly, the very first time it came into play was because of an incident right here in Newport at a local state park. Lauren Jackson, a trans woman who had just moved up here from Utah, was just viciously and really brutally attacked by a man from Idaho simply because she used the correct restroom. And luckily the perpetrator was caught. Luckily he was prosecuted and convicted under the Bias Crimes Act. And, you know, with so much partisan division in Salem, I was really proud and frankly a little astonished that it passed both the House and Senate without opposition. And I know this year Basic Rights Oregon is pushing for Oregon to finally do what so many other states have done and outlaw the trans panic and the gay panic defense. And I think that's the, you know, next big battle, but I think there's probably a lot more opportunities for pro-trans legislation in future years.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, this is a great conversation so far. So we've had Sheila talking about really making the point that, like, for instance, if you're playing a sport and you're doing curling, you know, you really shouldn't have any problems, whether you're no matter what kind of trans athlete you are. I think if you're doing curling, you're probably totally safe. And that's just, you know, there's hardly any Olympic athletes in the whole world, whereas there's a lot of trans women and a lot of transgender people in the whole world. I mean, compared to the number of Olympic athletes and the number of high school athletes, like, why is the conservative right you know, once again, using our transgender bodies as some sort of a pivot point in order to gain political clout, because that's exactly what they're doing right now.
Could I leap in on that for a moment,
please,
Emma?
Please, I mean, Claire, and then Jean, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, my theory on that is that strictly it is an issue, you know, the right nowadays, they want to make people afraid or they want to make them angry. And, you know, without doing any real research, that it just seems to be a huge hot button issue for the socially conservative right wingers. It's something, you know, I think bathroom bills lost some momentum. So now they've latched onto this issue, and unfortunately they're getting traction with it.
Yeah, let's go around to Jean and then we'll go back to Sheila.
Yeah, thank you, Emma. I want to make an observation in the context of this whole question of sports participation. And I make this observation, rarely, extremely rarely, almost non-existent in the ongoing debate and narrative, do I ever hear a real in-depth analysis of at what point in someone's transition do they then, you know, logically, rationally, realistically begin to participate in, you know, as a trans woman identified, you know, trans girl. Because this is all, you know, in the context of school sports mostly, to start to participate in their identified, you know, gender, and this whole thing is being framed as if it's like yesterday I was on the boys wrestling team and tomorrow it's like I come to school and go, hey, I'm a girl. And so now I'm entitled to participate in girls' sports, right? Well, forgive me, and you know, but let's deconstruct this a little bit, right? And I make this observation. I'm pulling, you know, a time frame kind of out of the air here. Probably 20 years ago, the International Olympic Committee came to grips. You know, I mean, actually going back all the way to the Cold War era, where, you know, the Eastern Bloc was accused of using, you know, hormone therapy and stuff to enhance capabilities in their women's, you know, sports. These standards have been internationally agreed to for decades. And what's wrong with simply embrace, you know, there's something wrong with this country in that we, you know, I mean, the Paris Peace Accord, I mean, you know, the conservatives are all like, you know, we're not going to participate anything that has to do with international, you know, the UN, I mean, you know, you look at the Heritage Foundation. Anyway, I'm going off on political stuff, but these standards have been established for decades. Now, I, for one, will take the side of saying, no, you know, I mean, I can't be, you know, on the boys' wrestling team yesterday and the girls' wrestling team tomorrow. That's illogical. It will never serve. We can never win that debate, okay? Ever.
Sheila, we haven't heard from you in a while. You want to chime in on this conversation?
Well, I've been enjoying how it has ricocheted back and forth, because what's interesting here, and the thing that frightens me the most, is the sophistication of the forces that are being used against us right now. One of the techniques is to create a fission between the LGBT world And the effort is to basically split off the T component, say LGB is going to be involving sexuality, whereas transgender people, by their mere existence, are acting, and this is where religion often plays a role, are acting against the will of God and are going to be a threat to the family, a threat to private women's spaces, a threat to women's sports, but always notice a threat. So instead of being victims or special needs people who need some understanding and some special adaptation to the things that we're struggling with, is turned around so that now we are the aggressors. We are the ones that are trying to upset the apple cart. And if we could just separate the T component, the LGB people could go on by themselves. And this is where we deal with TERFs. This is where we deal with incoming from so many different quarters that it's very hard to defend ourselves, because we're catching it from both the liberal and the conservative wings, because suddenly we're being positioned as being more powerful than we are, more numerous than we are, and more disruptive than we are. So we've lost control of our own narrative, and that's what frightens me. And when I get frightened, my tendency is to go back to my early experience, which was to say, in straight society or in the outer world, I'm fairly at risk. And so were my brothers and sisters at that time. And so my tendency was to say, well, then what we have to do is we have to be edgy. We have to especially be allied, which were my role models, were the drag queens, the ACT UP people, the people that were on the edge, that were unapologetic about being on the edge, never planned to be off the edge, and never assumed that they would ever really rejoin general society. So therefore would never quite merge, and therefore in that sense they were less of a threat, because the real fear that seems to be underlying this panic, this kind of cultural panic going on right now, is that somehow or other we might be so omnipresent or so invisible that we might pop up anywhere. And I want to tell a lot of these people to say, a lot of these things, you'd have to run an ad in the biggest city in the state to even find a transsexual in the whole state. It's, we're not around that much. And so it's a fear that's disproportionate to the cause. But the reason that they're so panicky is they consider us ultimately a cultural threat. We are threatening the non-binary modality that they seem to feel that their whole society is based upon. And then they come at us with every weapon at their disposal to make us either disappear or to come back to a binary modality, which many of us are saying, many today are saying, I don't even want to do the traditional transgender transition mode. I want to be non-binary, exist right in the middle, and not really be treated as a third sex, but at least to be said, I want my freedom not to have to advertise or not to trade one stereotype for another. So those are the things that are operative right now that I see, and they're frightening for me because I'm afraid, and I don't know personally how to deal with it. I don't know whether to kind of disappear again or be more radical than I used to, and go back to my old radical mode. It's a little harder as you get older. But anyway, it's leading with lots of questions to which I can't find an easy answer.
Thank you. So that's, again, this is, you're listening to Transpositive. Today is International Women's Day. We have a great collection of guests here. We have Claire, we've got Jean, we've got Sheila, and myself, Emma. And we're just doing the show because we are so grateful that KBOO is a space that welcomes and includes trans women. And I just like to, what Sheila was just talking about really got me thinking about something that has been a constant source of conversation within our community. And while we're in a trans women's space, I'd just like to ask you all if you could talk about maybe one or two things. One is, do you feel that, you know, the non-binary issue, which on Transpositive, we're very welcoming of non-binary people. We have a non-binary host, and we totally love and accept and welcome all of our non-binary, like, siblings, nibblings who are part of our community, because non-binary is just as important as transgender. But how do you feel non-binary as a category in relationship to your identity as a trans woman? That's one question. Another question that I have that's kind of come up around this conservative right talk is this whole issue of like this trans panic, which is like this idea that somehow there's all these kids and they're catching transgenderism because like they see other people being transgender. And there's this idea that somehow being transgender is just a fad. And like there's all these kids making these terrible life choices. And this is like one of the narratives that the right spins because they feel that we're some sort of a threat to their children. So I was just wondering if you could talk about either one of those or go in a totally different direction. Let's go around again. We'll start with Claire.
Well, you know, I've got to admit, as a 61-year-old, it was a learning curve for me, and meeting non-binary people for the first time, it was an eye-opener for me, and but I think I totally get it, and I totally respect it, although I've had some friends. It's interesting. I've got a lot of friends and acquaintances in the community, and some have said to me, well, gee, you know, I kind of understand you, that they're okay with somebody moving from one end of the binary to the other binary, but the idea of people being non-binary in the middle just really seems to baffle them. So I think, you know, that's an educational challenge all of its own. And, you know, this whole idea that, what was the terminology some conservatives have used, that, a trans child, all of a sudden it becomes the trendy thing. Other kids say, oh, I want to be transgender too. I think is just ridiculous.
Yeah. And it's important to note that any child who comes out within the school system as transgender, like automatically goes straight into, they get counseling, they get lots of information. When you're in school, you're protected by the school system. And so like discovering your gender identity is something that the school system is kind of learning right now how to negotiate by talking to professionals, people with, you know, degrees, with PhDs and counseling and psychology, who are learning as much as they can learn from us and from the kids. And they're doing it in a way that's incredibly thoughtful and inclusive. So,
yeah, that's great. Could I just the other day, I was talking to a woman I know who lives in Multnomah County, and she said her partner works in the schools essentially with, helping trans kids, especially negotiate the early phases of their transition. And she said, without exception, every child she's worked with, when they've been introduced to their classmates in their true identity, that the students have been welcoming, affirming in a very vocal way. And she said, the wonderful thing is that the teachers don't, really even try to encourage that. It's just spontaneous. And, you know, it's stories like that that give me hope for the future.
Thank you. Jean, I see you nodding your head.
Yes, Claire. I hope you saw me nodding my head as well, enthusiastically. A couple of thoughts here. First of all, Sheila, I'm not sure exactly where you fall generationally, but Claire, I got a few years on you too, hon. So I've been around for a while. and so owning that, I realize, and I've realized for a while, that I'm a pterodactyl,
Gene.
I'm a pterodactyl.
You don't look like a pterodactyl.
Don't let Revlon hair dye fool you, hun. yet I carry my lived experience. I can observe what seems to be happening around me, with other age groups. Yet, you know, my lived experience is my lived experience, and I'm always going to see things through those filters. You know, I'm not rigid. I can grow and learn, and my opinions have changed. But I completely concur, Claire, that the younger generation, and I celebrate what you're pointing to, in that we as a community, as an identity, are making and have made tremendous strides in a cultural evolution that will take time. It's going to take generations, but it's just amazing to me to see, you know, the perspective shift that seems to be represented in the younger generation, okay? Acceptance, just it's like, yeah, okay, what do you want me to call you now? You know, it's like, okay, cool, right? The kind of trauma that we experienced in our age bracket as we, you know, grew up is becoming less, depending upon where in the world you live, obviously. Yeah. Okay, I have to put that qualifier on it. Okay, with that said, Emma, to actually speak to a second piece of what you posed there, for me myself, as much as I, in a socio-cultural context, am, you know, I identify, you know, as low femme binary trans woman, you know, I mean, I'm a woman. That's been my objective my whole life. And I, you know, I've strived for that. I've made sacrifices to, you know, to be seen and responded to in that context. Nonetheless, when I addressed your question from an existential internal view, I must admit that once I got over my social transition, which I've already disclosed as, you know, been actually pretty seamless. I have passing privilege, and I don't face a lot of, you know, day-to-day struggles that some in our community do. Nonetheless, from that inward looking perspective, I have to really acknowledge that I am non-binary in the sense that there are elements of my personality, there are elements of my lived experience that are not exclusively feminine by any stretch of the imagination. And so I kind of internally place myself, I think, in that non-binary place on the spectrum. So thank you.
Thank you. So we've only got about like maybe five or 10 minutes left in the show. It goes so fast. You're listening to Transpositive, and this is International Women's Day, so we're just we're celebrating trans women, and we're really grateful that we live in Portland or near Portland, and that there's a radio station here that really is embracing and welcoming of, you know, queer people, people of color, really prioritizes the voices of people of color, and, you know, definitely makes room for queer people in its programming. And Sheila, do you have any final thoughts? We're going to just go around and do
Yeah, thank you. One of the things is how do we step out of narratives then that are trying to package us so that we can regain agency? This has always been our challenge. We have to recognize that to get a univocal definition of even what womanhood is going to be very hard. If you get a group of people together, they're always going to have different places where they're going to draw the borders. And one of the things that I always hope for social change is to get beyond borders. Well, we're living in a border conscious era. We're building walls on our southern border to keep immigrants out. We're deciding who is Catholic enough to be a real Catholic. People are coming down on Biden all the time for instance, favoring the Equality Act and saying, well, if you're really a good Catholic, you would never favor that. We have everybody trying to draw lines around everybody else to control them. And it seems to me a healthy society is one that can allow people freedom, point out errors, you know, sometimes save us from our own folly, because people do make mistakes. I want to put in a little word for the edginess, though. I think that the transgender experience came out of the 60s and the 70s, early GLBT consciousness. It came out of an awareness where people were saying, I don't want to have my life just exist in some sort of a canned Campbell's soup can, whether a male or female or transgender, where the path is laid out in front of me like rails for a choo-choo train, and I'm just going to follow those rails. Most of us dared to be self-defining, and to not so much because it was our choice, but because it was something deep within us that we had to deal with. And we tried to deal with the issue by every which way, to shut it down, ignore it, be invisible, be visible. My own tendency was to go for the people that I saw as our previous generation of transgender folk, which were people like April Ashley, people like Holly Woodlawn, the early Warhol superstars, Candy Darling. If you've never seen the wonderful documentary called Beautiful Darling done on Candy Darling's life, she was an early role model for me. And Holly Woodlawn, when she came up with her autobiography, said, are you, when I'm asked, am I a man or a woman? She said, what difference does it make as long as you look fabulous? And I always liked her attitude with that. And so what I'm thinking is the new generation with hormones and early sex reassignment are going to be much more invisible than we ever were, because they have two things going for them: youth, beauty, hormones, and surgery. Not all of us can afford all that, though, and there's a lot of us being killed on the streets. A lot of us are still massively marginalized, so there's always a class element in everything that we do, and we should never lose sight of that. So we're not a threat. We want to belong. We don't want our weaker members to be victimized. We don't want to victimize anybody else. And I think if we can concentrate on those issues and somehow survive this temporary little fascistic period that we're going through, and this cultural panic and this pandemic and everything else, and keep some of the flack from that coming our way, which we didn't cause it, we're not part of that, we are not a threat, we are just trying to live. I think that's our best shot at survival, and survival has always been what we've been about.
Thank you so much, Sheila. That's really just wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. We are just about out of
time.
You're
welcome.
So what I'm going to do, I'm so sorry to do this, ladies, but we're just about out of time. So what I'm going to do is go around and ask if you can just share any contact information or any way in which you'd like people to know about you. I'm going to start with Claire. And Claire, thank you again so much for being with us. This is the second time we've had you on the show, mm-hmm. and we're just so privileged here in Oregon to have an elected transgender woman serving as a county commissioner. Claire, if people would like to get in touch with you or find out more about what you're doing, how can they reach you?
Well, I think one of the best ways is I have both my personal Facebook page, Claire Elizabeth Hall, and I have a smaller page that's exclusively devoted to my own journey as a trans woman, and also I share what I think is important and relevant news, and that's called Claire's Corner. And if you look it up on Facebook and follow that, and you could message me through either one of those.
Great, thank you so much. And Sheila, just coming back to you for a minute, how can people find out about, I know you've written a whole bunch of books, including like several books on trans experience. Can you let us know how people can find out more about you? Or
the best way to do that is to go through my publishers, and they have different publishers. The first book is about a 400-page study of every question that I could ever answer on the transgender experience. It's called Transsexualism and Its Discontents, a Political Profile. And it's published by up in Washington by Kitsap Publishing for Tranny Goddess Press, which is my own imprint. And so that's the way to get that. Also, I have a separate book of short stories coming out as part of the Trinity Project of Blue Forge Press. And if you go to Blue Forge Press and ask for any of the Trinity volumes, because it's an anthology and I'm listed in all four of the seasonal, and there's four volumes of all the short stories with the other gender authors in that. But I also have a solo book with them. So just ask for Sheila at Blue Forge Press, and that will reach me.
Thanks so much, Jean. Why don't you close us out?
Okay, I will simply say that, you know, my out and proud profile really is represented right here on Transpositive PDX, probably in its most prominent way. But if anybody's interested into reading a very brief synopsis of my own transition story and stuff, it is featured on the webpage for the Transgender Health Program at Oregon Health Sciences University, where I am active and have been active. And there are a number of other forums where I'm active, but I will simply say, as far as social media and that kind of stuff goes, I have my boundaries.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining us tonight on International.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is hiring a membership director. Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/